Tonight we're going to take you through a series of time periods on this planet, beginning in 1930. Some incredible things that have happened. Timothy Good, one of the world's most respected authorities on alien phenomena, has drawn together years of in-depth worldwide research to put forward a case that is impossible to dismiss. Need to Know is a compelling exposé of top secret documents, interviews with key witnesses, and discussions with military and intelligence specialists, pilots, politicians, scientists. It is full of revelations, including the alarmingly high number of aircraft crashes following military attacks on UFOs, the disappearance of hundreds of military and civilian aircraft during UFO encounters, and the amazing information provided by a surgeon who operated on an alien captured by the Brazilian Army in 1996. Need to Know, UFOs, the Military and Intelligence, Timothy Good's new work, proves that UFOs are a real and current problem facing governments worldwide. The evidence presented by him that you will hear tonight, clear, balanced, and irrefutable. In a moment, Timothy Good. Timothy Good has conducted worldwide research on the UFO phenomenon, including interviewing key witnesses and discussing the subject with astronauts, military and intelligence specialists, pilots, politicians, scientists. As I mentioned, he has lectured at universities, schools, at many organizations, and has even been invited for discussions at the Pentagon, which was in 1998, and at the headquarters of the French Air Force in 2002. He has acted as a consultant for several U.S. congressional investigations. Born in London, Timothy Good gained a scholarship as a violinist to the Royal Academy of Music, where he won prizes for solo, chamber, and orchestral playing. He played for 14 years with the London Symphony Orchestra. He has also freelanced as a session player for television dramas, feature films, recordings with pop musicians. Among those he has recorded for, by the way, Phil Collins, George Harrison, Elton John, Paul McCartney, Rod Stewart, and U2. He's our guest tonight on Coast to Coast. Hello, Timothy. How are you? Welcome back.
Good evening. Thank you very much, George.
My pleasure. Great work, by the way, in new investigation, Need to Know, which we'll get into in just a sec. Tim, Nick Pope, making big news over the last week or so. Former member of the Ministry of Defense out there in the United Kingdom, looked into UFOs. He basically says the potential for war with extraterrestrials is real. You know him, Timothy. He thinks highly of you. I want just your overall on Nick Pope and what he's been saying.
I'm glad you raised this question, George, because actually I spent the evening with Nick last night, and we were just talking about the fact that he's recently resigned from the Ministry of Defense, not in the UFO chair, as it were, that he inhabited from 1991 to 1994, but his last tour of duty was as a sort of defense security expert specialist, and he has now resigned. And he has indeed stated in a press release that the subject has to be taken seriously, and it's quite possible that some of these beings pose a threat. And, of course, he's absolutely right. The difference between Nick Pope and myself, and he's well aware of this, is that, of course, that's not something that he could come out with officially, but I can come out with it unofficially because I'm not employed by the Ministry of Defense nor by any other government. And I can come out with these outrageous statements. It's my great pleasure to be able to do that. But, of course, it doesn't carry the official stamp. But as far as I'm concerned, not only is a threat posed, we are in a conflict situation and have been for quite a long time. And that is one of the major problems why those few governments around our planet who are aware of what's going on cannot possibly come out with this all at once.
It is probably so damaging, probably so frightening, Timothy, that if they went public with it, there'd be worldwide panic.
Well, some of the people in Washington and elsewhere I've spoken to feel that way. But there's also other things to consider. I mean, the effects on the stock market, the acute embarrassment. You know that politicians, nobody likes to look silly, particularly politicians. They like to let us know that everything's fine. You know, we're in complete control of the planet and the universe. We are not. And there is a situation going on, and we are not in control. And there is, I'm quite sure that the aliens are running the show as far as any kind of liaison that is going on. And I am convinced 100% that alien liaison has been going on for quite a long time with a select number of military and intelligence officials and a few people in the political world.
Well, I also think, Timothy, what it would do to religion worldwide. I think it would shatter it in some cases, wouldn't it?
I think so. I mean, can you imagine if it was acknowledged that some of these beings are millions of years ahead of us on the spiritual scale, and that some of them may have been responsible for planting or at least hybridizing mankind on Earth, and that some of our great religious leaders like Christ were in fact an extraterrestrial hybrid? There's no way they could come up with all this. You know, the churches and religions are very happy to keep their angels and saints and masters and so forth way out there in the heavens, fantasizing tales about what they might or might not have said. But if you bring that all down to earth, that really would shatter religion.
Yet, when you think of it in the scope of extraterrestrials, one still has to think somewhere of a divine creator, don't you think?
Absolutely. I mean, whatever you choose to call it.
Yeah.
I mean, the universe is phenomenal. I myself don't believe in the Big Bang theory. I think I find it completely unscientific, for starters. I think the universe is infinite. It never began, and it never will end. It's infinite.
You may be right. I think it was always here. And there may be many universes, Timothy,
absolutely,
that have always been here. You know, as I was reading the work that you've done, these revelations of these aircraft crashes during these encounters and the disappearance of the military and civilian aircraft encounters, this to me is startling.
Yeah.
You know, when I remember years ago when I watched the movie Close Encounters of the Third Kind, when the scene of the movie started with them in the desert, and they were looking at these returned old aircraft or a ship in the desert. But as the movie evolved, you realized that these objects with people, they were taken. They were taken out of the sea, snuffed out of the air. And, you know, you've looked at that. So let's start with your research from the time period of 1930 to 49. And why do you begin then?
Because the early 1930s were the first really events that led to official research by the military into the subject. Down in Australia, for example, Royal Australian Air Force reported odd things going on. A few aircraft and boats were disappearing during the 1930s, particularly in the area known as the Bass Strait, which is Australia's Bermuda Triangle. And right up to the late 1970s, you know, in 1978, when the young Fred Valentich disappeared with his Cessna aircraft in that area,
right,
after officially reporting, the whole thing's on the official transcript, after officially reporting a metallic solid object circling above him. And there have been many such incidents. So it must have been known since the 1930s that something pretty serious was going on.
All right. You start with some work initiated by Mussolini of Italy. Tell me about that.
Well, the story about Italy is that, according to Roberto Pinotti and Alfredo Lissoni, who've written a very good book on this aspect of the phenomenon, official secret research started in the 1930s in Italy following the sightings of unknown flying objects, which were chased in some cases by Italian Air Force planes. There was a reported crash of one of these objects, and there are many, many official documents which have been authenticated, chemical tests and so forth. And these reports indicate just how seriously the subject was taken at that time. And Marconi, the great scientist, was one of the directors of this outfit, Special Research Group number 33. And there are papers relating to that, secret papers, and I've reproduced a highly confidential report, courtesy of Pinotti and Lissoni. And it's just clear that these were probably the first official attempts at solving the phenomenon and the first official government research. in Italy, also in Scandinavia, in Sweden, they were very concerned in the 1930s, and in parts of Britain, and certainly in the United States, officials were concerned by so-called mystery aircraft at that time.
Now, in this particular case in Italy, there was also a report of an unknown craft that apparently had landed?
Yes, landed or crash-landed. I forget the exact area. I haven't got details in front of me, but there is a report of it. I have reproduced the actual the original Italian document relating, highly confidential document relating to that incident.
Now, during this period, as we're getting into World War II, are they seeing, are pilots seeing craft flying all over the place? You know, Royal Air Force. The French, are they all seeing something?
Absolutely. I mean, we talk about the Foo Fighters, but in a way this is a misnomer. Sure, there were numerous sightings of luminous, often spherical-shaped objects which pursued and buzzed aircraft during bombing missions and sometimes caused engines of bombers to cut out. But there were also sightings of sometimes quite large objects, and I've included for the first time a remarkable case reported by the crew of a Lancaster over France of an object which absolutely dwarfed the four-engine Lancaster bomber. Absolutely giant object. And there's also an official report that was secret from the British Ministry of Defense, or the Air Ministry as it was then known, about another incident reported by the crew of a Lancaster bomber regarding sightings, one of which was quite a large object traveling at a very, very high rate of speed, seen by the entire crew.
And what's so amazing about these reports, there's no way other nations, the Germans, anyone else, would have had that kind of technology.
Well, I'm glad you raised that, George, because often you get documentaries saying that the Germans really were responsible for UFOs. Had that been so, they would have won the war. They did not win the war, as we all know, and it is quite possible, indeed it's known, that the Germans were experimenting with disc-shaped aircraft, but that's a far cry from saying they were responsible for the Foo Fighter sightings. Absolutely daft, because Foo Fighters were seen in the Pacific theater of operations, they were seen in China, they were seen in the United States. They were seen in Soviet Union and, of course, in Europe, particularly over Germany and France.
Were there cases during this time period, Timothy, 30 to 1949, where there were military encounters where pilots, you know, attempted to shoot down craft or something happened to military craft?
Well, yes. Well, the first time, as far as I know, was the officially acknowledged occasion, very well known. I won't go into this in detail. Everyone knows it, I think, who's interested in the subject. But in February 1942, when 1,430 rounds of anti-aircraft ammunition were fired at unknown objects over the Culver City area of Los Angeles.
Right.
And there's a photograph of the event. There's an official declassified secret document confirmed by George Marshall that these things really happened. There is a rumor that something was brought down. Whether that something that was brought down was an American plane sent up, shot down accidentally, we do not know. But something was shot down, that's for sure. But as far as I know, the first instance when these things were shot at was in 1945, still just at the tail end of the war.
Mm-hmm.
This was reported to me by a Free French Air Force pilot, Sean Kisling, who was flying with a detachment of the United States Army Air Forces at an Air Force base in Michigan, near Detroit. And he was, there have been numerous cases of what they called balloons. You know, the famous Fugo balloons were rife at that time, 1945.
Sure.
They were drifted across the Pacific with balloon bombs. Many of them did not go off, but a few succeeded in doing so, and a few succeeded as getting so far as Michigan. So it was assumed when these things were seen over this particular Air Force base.
That has to be Selfridge Air Force Base.
Selfridge Field,
yep.
Yeah, absolutely. And the base commander asked for a volunteer to send up someone to shoot these Japanese balloons down, and a Free French Air Force pilot, Jean Kisling, volunteered, and he went up in his P-47 And he had to go very, very high. He pushed the plane for all it was worth beyond its service ceiling, maximum altitude. And he managed to get one of these things, a spherical-shaped object, in his gun sights, and he let rip with the eight machine guns on the P-47. And at that instant, the craft flipped on edge, so it became a very thin disc on edge, and then shot away at right angles. And then, as he said to me, you know, at that time, Tim, I realized it was no balloon.
So, oh, my gosh, something was happening there. And also, you report that 2 years before Roswell, which occurred in 1947, there was another episode in New Mexico.
Yes, this was reported by two witnesses who claim that in the village, actually, of San Antonito, near San Antonio, New Mexico, there was the crash landing of an object. And these two boys witnessed this event, and I believe they're writing a book about it. I did investigate this case at some great length. I made a special trip to Seattle to interview Remy Baca, one of the principal witnesses, who was a young boy at the time. Unfortunately, he suddenly refused to allow me to publish the case at all, actually, he claimed.
Why?
But unfortunately, I don't know. I think because he has his own agenda.
Maybe, okay.
Wants to do his own book,
sure,
fine, but
sure.
It let me down very badly. It let my publishers down because that was part of the thing. In any event, I have done a synopsis of the case, and that's on a public matter of public record anyway.
Sure.
And anyway, I was impressed by that case, and this was, as you say, you know, 2 years before Roswell.
Were there occupants in this particular case?
There were. They saw occupants, yes, small occupants. They were observing from a distance this craft.
Were they dead?
No, they weren't. They were moving around, darting around in a peculiar darting fashion. And the boys, to cut a long story short, they went home and they told one of them told the father, and the father phoned the police. Police phoned the military eventually, but anyway, they took the father out there together with a police officer, and the craft itself, I believe, had disappeared. There were no aliens sighted, but obviously, this thing had been parts of it at least had been taken away, and eventually, anyway, to cut a long story short, the boys actually saw the recovery operation of this vehicle being taken away. And one of the boys managed to actually get inside the craft at one stage before it was carted away.
They didn't cart him away with it.
Sorry?
They didn't cart him away with it.
They did not cart him away with it, no. No, this was when the military detail was sort of off in the local bar at the time, they took advantage. I mean, that you might think that's quite unlikely, that they wouldn't leave something like that.
Or somebody there guarding it or something, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, skepticism has been obviously that is, you know, a point. But at the same time, they probably didn't know what they had, you know, in 1945. That's my feeling, and it was a very difficult time towards the end of the war there. So I don't know. I find it mostly a credible story.
Timothy, stay with us. We'll be back with more. I'd like to get your take on why we attack fire on so many of these craft. We'll be back. We're with Timothy Good tonight. His most recent work, Need to Know, UFOs, the Military, and Intelligence. Timothy, who's provoking whom here? I mean, are we the ones firing on these UFOs first, or are they doing something in order to get us to do that?
Before we get on to that, George, I just want to make a few quick corrections about the Second World War and crashes of UFOs, crash landings. I've got several in my book, two from 1941. There's one apparently in near Cape Girardeau, Missouri.
Oh, sure.
There was one in 1941 in the Sonoran Desert in Mexico. There was the landing of a craft, which subsequently was able to take off in 1943 on the Baltic coast of Poland. There was one that came down at a naval air station in Hawaii in the spring of 1944, which I find intriguing. Now, regarding the New Mexico case of July 1945, I just want to make absolutely clear I got one fact wrong.
Okay, that's right. Go ahead.
When they went back, when these two boys, Faustino Padilla and Remy Barker, went back to take Padilla's father came along together with a state policeman who is named Eddie Apodaca. They went back to the crash site. The craft was actually still there, though it sort of remained hidden. It had been covered with dirt and debris, presumably by the military who had been in it, but the creatures had definitely gone, and the huge debris field had largely been cleared and raked over. But the craft actually remained where it had come to rest. And evidently the army had learned of the incident, and they came to retrieve it, take it away on a tall boy. And it was at that point, this operation lasted several days. And it was one night when the boys, actually one of them, Padilla, was able to gain access to the craft.
Okay.
And actually prized a souvenir off a barquette, it is claimed. And I've examined that sample.
What did it look like?
To me, it looks like a very terrestrial bracket, very, very light aluminium. It has been tested, and it's about 12 inches long, weighs 15 ounces, and contains holes, for rather conventional-looking fittings, I would imagine,
sure.
Which I find rather unconvincing. But it reveals, the acid tests and other analyses reveal the metal to be 200 series aluminium or similar. So I just wanted to get the facts clear on that case.
Okay, and also one quick question before we go to the who is the provocateur here.
Right.
Why so many crashes, Timothy? I mean, if they had the technological ability to get here, how would they crash? Why would they crash?
I think it depends on the cultures involved. There's not just one set of alien guys coming here. Nothing's perfect. If some of them are coming here for the first time, they're not aware that the effects that our radars might have had on their own propulsion systems. That's one theory that's been posited. For sure, we fired at some of them, 1942, for the first time, as far as I know. Now, what happened was, in 1947, April, May 1947, the U.S. Army was testing V-2 rockets, which had been captured, together with von Braun and his team of Nazi scientists. And they were working at White Sands. And now Linda has dealt with this, Linda Howe.
Right.
And I spent a lot of time with John Andy Kistner, a former state representative for Las Cruces, New Mexico. He's also in the aerospace industry for quite a long time. And I made special trips to Arizona to talk with him. I'm very, very convinced and very by the information that he's provided, and so is Linda. And he's very, very generously provided me with a wealth of information relating to that early period. And it's quite clear he's done fantastic research, and he's backed it up with newspaper articles reporting, for example, that in early 1947, one of the V-2 rockets, one of the very first ones that went up, was followed by an unknown object. It was filmed, apparently, and it was officially acknowledged, and I've actually reproduced, thanks to Andy Kistner, the newspaper article, and it said that unexplained phenomena were responsible for causing this V-2 to go off course. And at that stage, this was happening on a very regular scale. The U.S. Army started redoubling their efforts to try and get one of these craft down if they hadn't got them already, which is another moot point. I think they probably had. I think they needed to get as much technical intelligence as was necessary. So they started firing at these things big time, and even using proximity fuses, very early guided missiles were used to fire at these things, and apparently they succeeded in knocking several of these things down, and the one or the two that came down in New Mexico in July of 1947 were among them, apparently. They took several days to come down. People reported seeing objects fluttering, oscillating, sailing around the skies as if they were in some kind of trouble. And then, of course, we have the famous Roswell story, but it might have happened even earlier than that.
We started
firing at them, and then all hell let loose when thousands of air crashes started being reported worldwide, not just military, but civilian. And the newspaper articles I've reproduced in the book, New York Times and other articles, Truman ordered an urgent inquiry. Even in the same week, there were hundreds of planes crashing all over the world, sometimes on the same day. And in most instances, they were completely unexplained. The official explanation was that the planes were running out of fuel. You know, okay.
All of them?
Like, you know, like 5 minutes after takeoff. And many cases, of course, that's a ludicrous explanation. The other thing is that a lot of these aircraft were unable to get off the ground. It's called unsticking in the business. They could not unstick, and they just crashed at the end of the runway and exploded. And this went on for months, and thousands of people lost their lives. I think that can only be regarded as some kind of retaliation. Now, again,
massive retaliation.
Yes. Now, again, I mean, especially if you consider that, you know, airliners are involved here.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, how can any government on Earth, especially at that time in the Cold War and everything, admit that these sort of things are going on? So that's another reason for the cover-up. Now, I have got the actual official Department of Defense figures for unexplained incidents and other incidents, major aircraft incidents, just from 1952 to 1956, because...
Do you want to move into that time period now? Is that a good time right now?
I think so. While I have the figures in front of me, from 1952 to 1956, there were something like 18,662 crashes of just United States Air Force and Navy interceptors alone, all right? Those are the types of planes that would be involved in pursuing UFOs. All right, so it's very interesting that of those fatal crashes, about something like 9.5% were completely unexplained. That's a very high percentage.
Sure is. And then the rest of them that they explained, it may have been bogus explanations.
Yes, quite possibly. I mean, they say, for example, 56.2% were caused by pilot error, 8.1% by ground crew or other personal failure, 23.4% by failure of parts and equipment in the aircraft, 2.8% by various unsafe conditions, and 9.5% by unknown factors. So, you know, can you imagine people, military intelligence analysts coming to grips, being able to sort of comprehend all that, and least of all, letting that kind of information out?
Timothy, were there ever reports or documents that anybody's obtained that would have shown that, you know, our government was saying, we believe these craft are extraterrestrial, they're coming from some other system, some planetary system in the universe, we don't know where, but anything like that?
Absolutely. I mean, I've reproduced a document, if I can lay my hands on it right now, hopefully I can. This goes back to 1948, while I'm looking for it here.
Is that the Swedish document?
That is, yes.
Okay.
Well, it's actually United States Air Force Europe top secret document, which is reproduced. If I could just get my hands on
All
it
right.
here, I have it here. Yes, it's dated 4th of November 1948, classified top secret. It has been officially declassified by the National Archives in Washington. And there's a very interesting quote. It's regarding liaison discussions with U.S. Air Force Europe intelligence analysts with their Swedish counterparts. And some of the comments in this top-secret document, which is reproduced here, I have it, says, fully technically qualified people have reached the conclusion that these phenomena are obviously the result of a high technical skill which cannot be credited by any presently known culture on Earth.
Oh, my gosh.
They are therefore assuming that these objects originate from some previously unknown or unidentified technology, possibly outside the Earth.
That's incredible.
Mm.
I mean, when you look at that and you start putting it into perspective, you have got to make the assumption that this planet has been and is being visited.
Absolutely.
I'm concerned about the altercation. That that bothers me the most.
Yeah.
Do you believe, and we're going to go through the 50 to 59 time period in a moment, but do you believe this is still happening, the altercations?
Yes. Yes. What has been explained to me by various well-informed sources is that there is a conflict situation. It's been going on for a very long time.
Like a certain group?
In terms, there are goodies and baddies.
Right.
And the baddies have got their beady eyes on this planet.
And the goodies can't stop them.
I think they have to a certain degree. I suppose there are sort of universal protocols for the degree of involvement in these interplanetary affairs. But my feeling is that we have been helped. We do have allies.
We have
definitely been helped. And there is a conflict situation regarding this planet going on without the knowledge of the majority of us.
Is it possible that because we are such a warring civilization, that the seeding of our planet, which I believe occurred,
yes,
may have been done by these warring extraterrestrials that are still coming back, that are still fighting, that are still trying to annihilate us?
I think it's quite possible. I will go so far as to say, and I've gone so far in my book, that we are not the first humanoid species on this planet. There have been civilizations going way back, thousands, maybe millions of years before Homo sapiens. I'm absolutely convinced of that. I'm 100% convinced we are a hybridized species going back maybe 200,000 years, something like that, when this planet was colonized.
And they have high technology.
There are remnants still here today, and this would explain the extraordinary, for example, Bermuda Triangle. I'm sure that there are remnants of these cultures that have been on this planet longer than we have. They're still there. And so you could say that a lot of this stuff comes actually from this planet, highly advanced spacecraft and beings capable of interplanetary, interdimensional travel, whatever you like, from this planet, as well as beings from outside. And this is another problem for governments to say that we're not the only fellows inhabiting this planet.
I'm convinced, Timothy, that there's something genetically wrong with us because of the warring.
That's for sure.
Yeah. And it's very possible that our cousins may have been the cause of all this.
Right. We're in serious need of more genetic engineering, George.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, tell me about these so-called good extraterrestrials. Do you believe, then, that they have been battling, warring against the bad ones, and they have basically covered our back right now, watched our back?
To what extent, George, as I said earlier, I don't know, but there are good beings, maybe millions of years ahead of us, spiritually, technically, and everything else, with whom we are related, who want to do the best for mankind. But to what extent they can intervene, I do not know. What I do know, and I think this is the good news, is that I very much doubt they would allow this planet to be destroyed, even if the humans existing on it are destroyed.
Do you think that the battle with these other races of extraterrestrials, they would like to either extinguish the human race or destroy the planet?
I think no, neither. I think we are needed. I think the abduction program, for example, obviously we are of some use. Now, the question is if the abductions are for hybridization purposes, as is generally accepted, there might be more subtle things going on. I don't know. We can talk about that later, maybe. But if that's the case, is it for their benefit or for ours? Are they creating a hybrid between their stock and ours for their benefit or for our benefit? They're fond of saying it's for our benefit. I'm very, very suspicious. I think it could more likely be for their benefit, perhaps to make certain beings, their beings, more adaptable to this planet.
You said something interesting at the beginning of this hour, and that was for the few governments that know what is happening.
Sure.
Why don't all the governments know what is happening?
Because they don't have a need to know.
And these episodes aren't occurring in their own countries, or they just can't figure it out?
No, that they are, but if they do, when they do happen, usually Uncle Sam takes over. This happened in Brazil. I mean, from the 1950s, U.S. Naval Intelligence was liaising with their Brazilian counterparts, and they actually revealed a great deal of information to the Brazilians about what was going on. And this was exposed by Dr. Alevo Fontes, one of the world's greatest UFO researchers ever. And I've cited a lot of his work in, I think, most of my books, and a lot in my current book. And also, you know, when we had the incident at Varginha in 1986, you've had Roger Lear on the program many times. This is a real case. I know Roger. I'm convinced that the case with the surgeon is absolutely true. He kindly let me use that story. The thing is, who came in and took the aliens away? Uncle Sam. So there is a control. The Americans are in control. The Americans liaise with their Russian counterparts. There is definitely liaison with Russia and the United States and a few other countries. And again, it's on a need to know basis.
Right, and they are putting the lid on all of this.
Yes, it's been agreed that there's no way this can come out all at once. And what I've been told, I mean, one of my friends in Washington, I said once, this was about 5 years ago, I said, "Now come on, you know, you must know I've been interested since I was a boy, 1955. How much longer do we have to wait before some kind of official disclosure?" And he looked at me and smiled and he said, "Stay healthy." So I think what I get, there is an agenda, and it's kind of slow release. But what concerns me is that events may sort of expedite the situation. This is the problem that they have. No one can forecast precisely what's going to happen, and maybe they have to prepare us a bit more quickly.
When we come back, we're going to go through the 1950 to 1959 period and eventually get up to where we are right now with some startling cases. Those of you who might remember the late astronaut Gordon Cooper, he described an incredible situation of interceptions of UFOs in 1951. We'll talk about that and some other cases when we come back. Timothy, is the book Need to Know, is it available in the United States yet?
It isn't, George. It's due for publication late April, May of next year by Pegasus Books.
We are really getting a jump start on this one, aren't we? You'll have to let me know exactly when it's out then, and then I'll make sure everybody knows about it. We'll put a link up there for you on our Coast to Coast website.
Will do.
1950 to 59, very fascinating time period for UFOs and UFO encounters. Of this time period, which events stand out the most for you?
I think, George, I'd have to say the disappearances. And the most spectacular one, for example, was in late 1953 when a jet was sent up to intercept a UFO from Otis Air Force Base in Massachusetts, on the coast there. And what happened was that the plane lost all power and it hadn't reached a very high altitude. I'm just trying to check. It was actually an F-94C Starfire, which had been scrambled to intercept this unknown torque. This target.
And at that time, that was our state-of-the-art machinery. That was our aircraft.
It was, absolutely. Anyway, what happened, the pilot obviously gave instructions to bail out. And normally, the radar operator in the rear seat goes first, but he wasn't moving. And since the ground was coming up, you know, losing altitude, the pilot ejected. After ejecting the canopy, the pilot ejected. Landed safely, the parachute managed to open in time, fully expecting the radar observer to be somewhere near. No radar observer. The radar observer was never found, neither was the Starfire interceptor, despite months of searching all over, under the sea, everywhere. Never found. The only thing that was recovered was the cockpit canopy, which had been ejected. Now, that was not a rare event. It was happening frequently. Events like that, disappearing aircraft, disappearing people, pilots particularly.
My gosh. I mean, it just makes you scratch your head, Timothy.
Yeah. Again, how can governments come out with this? You know, I mean, just it's not as if people have recovered from the fear of terrorists crashing our airliners and planes, you know. But to admit that, you know, there's a possibility of a threat from elsewhere relating to the aviation industry is just, you know, it can't be done.
This time period, 50 to 59, around 51, 52 period, yeah, was that incredible UFO flap over the White House, and we, yeah, couldn't do anything about it.
No, and I think to this day a lot hasn't come out about that. I mean, some of they talk about sort of ephemeral objects darting about, sometimes on radar, sometimes not, but perfectly solid objects were seen sometimes at very low altitude, even at low altitude over D.C. at that time, as I reported in the book.
Now, let's see, who would have been the U.S.? It would have been Eisenhower, right?
General Eisenhower, yes.
Yeah, it would have been Eisenhower. I wonder what he said about all this.
Well, there's not a lot on record that he's actually stated about the subject, to the best of my knowledge.
Yet there are reports, incredible reports, that he met with extraterrestrials at Edwards, yes, Air Force Base in California, right?
In 1954, absolutely. I'm convinced that meeting took place, and we now have evidence that more people, you know, were actually attending there, and so there's sort of additional testimony from some of these people. This took place at the top secret Muroc, it was called at that time, Muroc Air Force Base, in February of 1954. It's sort of take us to your leader syndrome, you know, and Eisenhower was taken. It was an officially arranged meeting. There were at least one craft landed at the base, supposedly, and there were other officials with Eisenhower at the time.
I wonder how in the heck they communicated.
Well, they spoke in English, apparently, and they also demonstrated their telepathic abilities and their ability to make themselves and their craft invisible, which caused Eisenhower considerable embarrassment.
I would guess so. was this a demand meeting, do you think? What do you think they talked about specifically?
Well, it is alleged. I'll just give you the name of some of the people that were allegedly there. Franklin Allen of the Hearst newspapers, Cardinal James McIntyre, bishop and head of the Catholic Church in L.A., Edwin North of the Brookings Institution, who had been President Truman's financial advisor, and other people.
And I guess these people are all dead now, aren't they?
Yes, and other people have subsequently come forward, and I've named some of them in the book. But allegedly, one of the things that was discussed was that they wanted to set up a kind of education program for the people on Earth in order to make mankind more aware of their presence here. And Eisenhower was unnerved by this and reportedly indicated to them that he kind of didn't think the world was ready and that such a revelation would create a very difficult situation for everybody. And according to a test pilot who was present at this meeting, the aliens further seemed to understand Eisenhower's position, and they indicated that they would continue to make further isolated contacts with humans, but they abandoned the idea of a sort of mass landing or exposure.
Which is what they would have preferred to have done.
Yes. And I think so. But now there's another significant alien encounter in the same year, reported by Air Marshal Sir Peter Horsley, who is a former pilot, flew many of our great fighter and bomber aircraft. He'd also been deputy commander of Strike Command, with his finger on the nuclear trigger, as they say. And he spent 7 years serving the Queen and Prince Philip, Duke of Edinburgh, as an equerry. That's kind of like a sort of military attaché. And during that period, when he was working at Buckingham Palace, as he revealed in his autobiography, and as I wrote first about in my book Alien Base, he had a two-hour meeting with an extraterrestrial friend, arranged for him by a British Army friend, in the middle of London, which he found very disturbing indeed, particularly since this alien could read all his thoughts. And a great deal of information was exchanged during that meeting, and Sir Peter told me my last meeting with him. But the most disturbing thing for him was that the fact that this alien knew all Britain's top secret nuclear secrets. So it was made quite evident that this was a major point of concern, our developments in that area.
Did they explain what these creatures looked like?
Well, these were very, very similar to human beings. I mean, as far as this guy in London, he was just described as absolutely human. He could easily pass for an Earth creature.
Which means we may have been, you know, seeded from them.
Oh, absolutely, in my opinion. Sure.
And this has probably, Timothy, been going on for thousands of years. These encounters.
Or maybe more, who knows.
You write, and this is a fascinating one, about a photo reconnaissance flight near North Dakota.
Yes.
With a huge B-36 bomber. Tell us about that case a little bit. This one's incredible.
Yeah, I don't have the facts in front of me, but in 1956, a B-36 Peacemaker bomber capable of holding nuclear weapons was approached by a 100-foot diameter disc, which was seen by the entire crew, 17-man crew and a relief crew as well. And I wish to heavens I had photographic memory, I could sort of fish around the pages and everything, but I think it was there for something like 8 or 10 minutes, during which time it was filmed or photographed with cameras, Hain cameras, specially issued by Project Blue Book in the event of such occurrences.
Oh,
when the aircraft landed, all the cameras were confiscated.
So these photos are somewhere.
Oh, gosh, yes. We have photographs. I mean, look at the instance following year, 1957, when Gordon Cooper was flight test director at top secret Edwards Air Force Base, which used to be called Muroc, in California, when a craft actually landed and was filmed by Gordon Cooper's camera crew. Extraordinary story. Great detail. Cooper himself just had a brief look at some of the frames from the movie film. All sorts of film, still film and movie film was used. Very, very clear pictures of this craft. It extended landing gear, and then it took off everything on film. It was sent back by special pouch to Washington. And Gordon Cooper was told, not to actually look at the whole film, but no one told him. I mean, he did see some of the frames of it, that's for sure, but he didn't see a projected version of it.
I remember talking to him when I was in St. Louis, and he was describing his encounter with he was flying an F-86 jet.
Sabre jets, that's right, yeah. This was at Neubiberg Air Force Base in 1951.
In Germany, right?
In Germany, that's right, U.S. Air Force's Europe.
Incredible story. I mean, and he was convinced what he saw.
Yep.
Were UFOs?
Yeah, I mean, I've got the case in front of me now, and there was an alarm, and he said one day this was a regular occurrence, you know, sending up jets to chase the saucers. He said one day the alarm sounded, my squadron mates and I dashed from the ready room and scrambled skyward in our F-86s to intercept the bogies. Names were unknown.
He was one of the seven original astronauts, and he was not
Absolutely.
Kidding.
Yep. He said, we reached our maximum ceiling of around 45,000 feet, and they were still way above us, traveling much faster. I could see they weren't balloons or MiGs or like any aircraft. The metallic silver and saucer-shaped. He says, for the next 2 or 3 days, the saucers passed over the base daily, sometimes appearing in groups of 4, other times as many as 16. They could outmaneuver us and outflank us seemingly at will. So these things were quite commonplace.
This time period, 1950 to 59, I also used to remember reading books and stories later on in my, because I was born in 50, but later on into the early 60s, Frank Edwards.
Yeah.
Great reporter.
Oh, sure.
Did a superb job at that time. He kind of reminds me of you, Timothy, in that, in terms of an evolution of the progression of UFOs and extraterrestrial investigations, he was one of the first.
Absolutely. My work was inspired initially by Donald Kehoe, for whom I have enormous respect.
Yes.
That's how I got interested back in 1955. I still cite his work in my books and that of Frank Edwards, for whom I had enormous admiration as well.
Donald Kehoe.
Superb, superb journalist.
Kehoe, at the time, head up the National Investigations Committee on Aerial Phenomena.
NICAP, that's right. Yeah. Yes, until it was infiltrated by the CIA.
And disbanded eventually,
yes.
Right?
Yeah, sure.
I remember that. I mean, as a kid, I joined as a little member, and I got my card from them, and
yeah.
It was based in Washington, D.C. That I'll always remember.
Yes, absolutely. I don't think any group in the world has ever succeeded as that one had done to get the subject across to the people, and with such fantastic support from military officers, retired and sometimes current. Amazing.
Yeah, they had heavy hitters in that organization in
Absolutely.
Those days.
Absolutely, all sorts.
So this was a time period, I think, where UFO reports, sightings, and encounters might have been at their peak, 50 to 59. What do you think?
Yeah. I think so. Since that time, it's sort of less. There's more pockets of events in a shorter period. This was just going on and on, you know, day after day in the 1950s. There were sometimes sort of lapses in activity, but generally speaking, you know, there seem to be much quieter periods, don't there, these days? That's for sure.
I mean, because there's no doubt that during that period, something was happening because there were too many military pilots, too many commercial pilots reporting these very strange and unusual lights. There was too much interest by government and with individuals, and even newspapers of this era reported on, you know, sightings where newspapers today, they really won't handle it. I mean, you've got to land on the White House lawn before they're going to do a major story on this.
Yeah, and it's quite clear that even people that you might think would have a need to know about what was going on at the time did not, including Major Cabell. He was head of Air Force Intelligence in 1950-51 area, and there was a top meet, according to Ed Ruppelt, who was,
Headed up Blue Book.
Project Blue Book. There was a top-secret meeting held at the Pentagon to discuss the UFO situation, presided over by General Cabell and his entire staff. And in his private papers, Ruppelt reveals some astonishing information that he obtained, that Cabell just went absolutely bananas. He said, I want an open mind. I order an open mind. Anyone that doesn't keep an open mind can get out now. And he asked about the results of investigations to date of several good sightings, but telephone check to Air Technical Intelligence Center showed they'd been lost. No one could ever find them. And he went purple in the face. He said, what do I have to do to stir up the action? Anyone can see that we do not have a satisfactory answer to the saucer question. He demanded that the project be reorganized because directives weren't being followed. And he looked at his staff of colonels for a long time and said, I've been lied to and lied to and lied to and lied to. I want it to stop. I want the answer to the saucers, and I want a good answer. And it's very interesting that he cited the Mantell case when the incident in January 1948 when Captain Mantell lost his life pursuing a UFO. And he said that Cabell said he'd never heard such a collection of contradictory and indefinite statements. And he had a great deal of doubt in his mind that the sources were all hoaxes, hallucinations, or representation of known objects. And I love this. He took a swing at the Project Grudge report, which you may remember, which was largely sort of reinforced by the negative conclusions of Alan Hynek, saying that it was all explainable and so on.
And boy,
so
did
forth.
He change his tune later on in life.
Yes.
Didn't he?
Yeah. And this is what General Cabell, head of U.S. Air Force Intelligence, he described it as the most poorly written, inconclusive piece of unscientific tripe that he'd ever seen.
I have got to ask you in the moments we have before the break, about the U.S. Army soldiers that were firing at a UFO during the Korean War, and they were irradiated.
Absolutely, yes.
What happened here?
Well, this I haven't got the details in front of me, but I shall find them presently. But an unknown flying object appeared in this area. of Korea during an exchange. And of course, the U.S. Army guys were convinced that this was, you know, something Korean. So they let rip. They started firing at this thing and actually managed to strike the object. And it could be heard, the rounds clanging against
right.
this
Ding.
Thing. Yeah. I don't have the details in front of me. I wish I could find them, George. What happened was, the upshot was that the craft started behaving in a very erratic manner, and a beam of light came towards the soldiers. It irradiated them. They became very ill with what I can only describe as a type of radiation sickness, and they were debriefed about it, and some of them, soldiers, were taken away to hospital. A very serious incident.
Timothy, when we come back, we'll talk about the time period, 1960 to the present time,
mm-hmm.
where this time period now from the 60s on became very interesting, very fascinating in the UFO field. There was almost as if a change by the mindset of these extraterrestrials, yet we continued to try to fight with them, didn't we?
Yes. This was the problem. Quite obviously, it was dangerous to go shooting at these things, and most air forces were aware that there's a likelihood that the pilots would lose their lives or the plane would disappear or whatever. But the instructions still went out. Why? I think I can understand why, that military and technical intelligence people wanted to acquire as much information as possible. So there was still an attempt to knock some of these things out of the sky.
Stay with us, Tim. We'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. We now take you into the 1960s. Timothy, anything in your research about, at that point, the newly elected John F. Kennedy and his knowledge of UFOs, or things that he might want to reveal prior to his assassination?
Absolutely. I mean, for the first time, I was lucky to speak to a White House staff member at the time of that administration who knew Kennedy rather well, and I was able to acquire a considerable body of information, which I can share. I have published it in the book. This is what I've learned. Around 1961 to 1962, I'm quoting here my source.
Okay.
President Kennedy expressed a wish to see the alien bodies associated with an alien crash site. He had obviously been informed of their existence and wished to see for himself the evidence. General McHugh was in charge of the arrangements at the time, and Air Force One was used to take Kennedy and other top brass on this visit. The purpose of the flight was closely guarded. However, the reason for Kennedy's flight became evident to senior personnel on board through unguarded comments and the whispering which went on. Remember that even the pilots were members of the White House staff, ex-military, and trusted implicitly. Originally, the alien bodies were located at Patterson or Peterson Air Force Base and later moved to Tyndall Air Force Base, Florida, near Pensacola. These comments are from the horse's mouth, a person who was close to Kennedy at the time and a member of the White House staff. Since any alien evidence has been covered up for as long as rumor has existed, the United States authorities are unlikely to admit their complicity or make information available to you. There is clearly an international agreement in force between all governments to withhold information on alien and UFO phenomena. Well, that is essentially the information I acquired, and I subsequently learnt just a little bit more as well, which again I have published in the book. But essentially that's it.
Do you think that had anything to do with, and I'm sure it wasn't just it, but anything to do with his assassination? The fact that maybe one day he wanted to go public with this?
I can only give my own opinion, George. I have no information. I do think so, yes. And here's for why. You may remember the famous Maury Island incident several days before Kenneth Arnold's sighting in June of 1947, when this craft was seen allegedly spewing bits of wreckage and everything appeared to be in trouble. The principal investigator of that case was a guy called Fred Chrisman, who was had been a counterintelligence agent for a number of agencies, United States Air Force Intelligence, CIA as well. Just coincidentally, he was one of the three tramps picked up at the Dealey Plaza. Do you remember those tramps?
He was one of them?
He was one of them, Fred Christensen.
Well, now, what are the odds of that happening?
Exactly.
That's amazing.
And he was heavily into counterintelligence involving the UFO subject. So I've just mentioned that as an aside in the book, in the reference section.
I also wonder, Timothy, if on that plane flight to go witness the bodies, the creatures, if Kennedy brought Marilyn Monroe with him, because there have always been rumors that she was going to say something, and that's why they possibly did her in.
Yes. Well, I have no evidence regarding that, but I do find her death very suspicious, that's for sure.
Back to the 60s through 2006, and of course we'll get into the many things that have been going on in this time period, but you mentioned a little bit about a Hollywood actor, Stuart Whitman, whom I used to remember. I don't know if he's still alive or not.
I don't know. Maybe you could find out. Maybe you could get him on the program.
Yeah, matter of fact, I'll find out within minutes while you and I are talking if he's alive or not.
Yes.
But he communicated with UFOs.
Yes, this was during the famous power cut. Do you remember?
That was in 65.
November 9th, 1965.
Yeah.
It was definitely caused by UFO activity, in my opinion, and it was the opinion of professionals like Dr. James McDonald, for example, as he pointed out in a hearing before the House Committee on Science and Astronautics, that how a UFO could trigger such an outage on a large power network is not clear, but this is a disturbing series of coincidences because there were UFOs seen at that time. Anyway, Whitman was alone in his hotel room in New York City during that blackout, and he says he was awoken just before dawn by a whistling sound. I think he said it was similar to a whippoorwill. And two strange objects could be seen outside of the window, and one of them was orange and the other blue. They gave off strange luminescent light, so I couldn't see if they were portholes or what. Then I heard them speaking to me as if they were on a loudspeaker. They spoke to me in English. It may not have been audible to anyone else. I was probably tuned into the right wavelength. They said they wanted to talk to me because I appeared to have no malice or hate in my soul. They said they were fearful of Earth because Earthlings were messing around with unknown quantities and might disrupt the balance of the universe or their planet. They said the blackout was just a little demonstration of their power and that they could do a lot more with almost no effort. It served as a warning. They said they could stop our whole planet from functioning. They asked me to do what I could to fight malice, prejudice, and hate on Earth, and then they took off. I felt elated. I wasn't even shocked. I was standing by the window and awake the entire time. I don't know why they picked me as a contact, but I'll swear off a Bible that I saw them out there and that they talked with me.
He's 80 years old, so he's still alive out there.
Great.
Maybe we'll try to find him. That would be an incredible story.
Yes.
I will try, and we'll get him on the program. During the 60s, what events for you, in terms of the what you investigated, stand out the most?
Oh, goodness me, George. There was so much going on at that time. You remember we talked about the 1950s. There were spasmodic gaps in the 60s, but, I mean, 1965, I was in South America touring with a symphony orchestra at the time, and all the papers had headlines about it. They were all over South America at that time and other parts of the world. 67, I think, was a watershed year, no question. Things quietened down in 66, but generally speaking, 1967 was a bumper year all over the planet. I don't know which one to single out, though, but just so many.
Well, then I'll ask you a few questions about some. Did you ever investigate, in this area fascinates me, underwater UFOs?
Oh, absolutely, and I've got lots of those in the book. And I think for the first time in any sort of substantial degree, sightings by naval observers, naval officers, Chilean Navy, naval officers, Royal Canadian Navy, United States Navy, and the Soviet Navy. And those reports kind of increased in the 1960s and 1970s. And we tend to overlook them. I mean, most of this planet is sea. You know, two-thirds of the planet is water, and there have been an awful lot of things. The United States Navy is sitting on a vast amount of information. They've released barely anything, but I have spoken to naval officers who've had the most incredible sightings, like Jim Kopf in 1971, who held top-secret crypto clearance at the time. And he's confirmed that in 1971, a huge UFO was observed above the deck of the aircraft carrier, the USS John F. Kennedy, in 1971, and it disrupted all operations on the aircraft carrier, paralyzing communications. Normally, aircraft carriers carry an interceptor on board to intercept unknown craft. The Phantom jet, the F-4, could not get off the ground. The engines wouldn't start. Electrical breakdowns, malfunctions, the whole lot. This was only seen. Jim Kopf is the guy's name, James M. Kopf. The case has been published before, but he was able to give me a lot more information, and extraordinary that relatively few people actually saw it at the time. It was at the end of an exhausting exercise in the Caribbean at that time. It was somewhere in the vicinity of Cuba, I think, where the event happened. But at any event, it was very, very disturbing. Jim Kopf thinks that probably no more than about 20 people may have actually witnessed this huge spherical-shaped massive object above the tower, as they call the bridge area on an aircraft carrier. I mean, there's 5,000 guys were on board at the time, but only relatively few people actually saw it, though everyone was aware of the power failures. This was happening to lots of naval ships at the time.
Oh, yeah.
Particularly those carrying nuclear weapons.
Or they'd be tracked, right?
Yes, sure. I mean, not only were they tracked, I mean, all those kind of tapes, the radar tapes, sonar and everything, none of that has been released. When entries were made into the logbooks on an aircraft carrier, I think there's probably at least different logbooks. What happens is they're either expunged or they're changed in the handwriting of the person making the entry, or they're just completely, completely deleted. And that is true. This is why you'll never get anything unless any pressure is put on the United States Navy. They have great more knowledge on this subject than the other services, since they probably have evidence or proof going back further than the Air Force. That's my opinion.
What do you think is going on with these alien abductions? What's your take? I mean, David Jacobs thinks there's something sinister going on.
I agree with him.
Bud Hopkins has his thoughts. What do you think?
Well, I've spoken to both. I'm a great admirer of both writers. I think, although some of the abductions have definitely been benign, I do feel there is a sinister element to what has been going on. I don't speak just from what I've read, but from my own personal experiences. It's not generally known, and I haven't really discussed this in my books much. And certainly I haven't discussed my quasi-abduction experiences at all, either on the airwaves or in a book.
No,
but
that's
except
true.
From the fact that I have had, on hundreds of occasions, I've suffered from night paralysis, and it's got nothing to do with the official medical explanations, because I've shared that experience for example, a girlfriend at the time was experiencing it. I have always fought against it. I have always, as far as I know, managed to get out of it. It's definitely accompanied by a very sinister feeling, I have to say. I do not, certainly in my experience regarding abductions. Let me quickly give you the most recent episode, George.
Okay, please.
Only twice in my life have I actually seen anything or experienced any quasi-abduction experience. And in March of this year, I went to sleep, I remember, at 5 to 1. The next thing I knew, I was out in a road somewhere looking up at a triangle in the sky with white lights along each rim. It looked as if it was stuck in the sky. It was dark gray. I couldn't see stars or anything, but I could feel the night air on my face. I don't know where it was, and suddenly I felt myself being drawn up into the craft, and I just gradually resisted the paralysis feeling, and I shouted out for help. And I woke up, and I woke up at 1:05. So whatever that was, I don't know, but it was very real. And I did not get a good vibe from that at all.
I want you
that's
to...
the first time I've discussed that publicly, by the way.
Yes, it is. And thank you for sharing that with us. You mentioned earlier this 1978 case of the young pilot who was in his small plane. He saw a disc. In
metallic craft over the Bass Strait in Australia. Yeah, Frederick Valentich.
Somewhere there's a recording of him calling this in, isn't there?
Oh, the whole thing has been. I haven't actually heard his tape, but Dick Haynes of the National Aviation Center for Reporting Anomalous Phenomena has, I think he's heard the tape, and he's written a book on the case, an outstanding book. There is another, I have actually heard a tape of another incident in 1980 involving two young Puerto Rican pilots who were flying between the Dominican Republic and Puerto Rico in a light aircraft when they were being threatened. I can only use that word. They were being threatened by an unknown flying object, which was causing them to change course. And this is all a matter of official record because the National Transportation Safety Board has released a document. I've reproduced a page from it. They say that this thing was not an aircraft. It was very threatening. And that was the last that was heard from them, despite a five-day air sea rescue search. And those two young pilots simply disappeared together with their aircraft. How can any government come out with this stuff? But they have, because the actual transcripts of some of these incidents has been released.
Can you help us get a copy of this tape of this individual who disappeared in Australia?
I don't have a copy of it, George. The only person I did just hear it, but I wasn't allowed a copy at the time. But I know that Jorge Martin in San Juan in Puerto Rico has a copy of that. Whether he's likely to make it available, I don't know. But I would think certainly the National Transportation Board must have something on it, or the San Juan International Airport officials might help you there.
That would be incredible.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, absolutely. And what about Haynes himself? Might we be able to get it from him?
You could ask Dick, yes, sure.
Okay, we can track him down on that. Truly, the 60s and into the 70s, incredible time periods. And here we are now. Let's move now. We're going to take calls next hour. But we're in this time period now. What's going on in the field of ufology, Tim?
Well, events seem to be fairly spasmodic. I mean, unless you sort of follow the internet rumors and numerous alleged videos of UFOs and things, some of which are genuine, I'm absolutely sure, but most of which is really not to be discarded, I think. But there seems to be a lot going on in South America, but events in this country appear to be very spasmodic at the moment. But I have highlighted some very disturbing cases, talking about harassment of aircraft and a threat to aviation safety in Northern Ireland, in Dublin, in the Republic of Ireland, starting in January 2004, I have case of, for example, an Aer Lingus Boeing 737 on its final approach. According to a British Midland Airbus pilot behind, 5 miles behind, could see a large triangular object rose up from the ground and harassed this airliner, causing the outside air temperature to go up to 164 degrees Celsius, causing the plane's wings to be damaged. He couldn't operate. The air brakes were damaged as well. The plane landed safely, thank God. This was in the evening. 2 hours later, another similar incident occurred involving an identical-looking triangular-shaped craft which harassed another airliner on its final approach. So there you have these cases, all officially denied, but very, very disturbing for governments. But they do. It's not common. I hasten to add, it is not common.
These reports that these beings are being, that people are being taken by these craft.
Yep.
Where are they taking them? I mean, are they taking them back to their planet? Are they dissecting them? What are they doing with them?
I don't think they're dissecting them.
Let's hope not.
Short answer, George. I don't know, but I think it's quite obvious that hybridization is a very, very strong part of their agenda.
Do they?
But I would just wonder, I mentioned earlier, I might go further, but I have a feeling if there's something more sinister going on, they might be after more than just sperm and ova. You know? So think about that.
That could be. That could very well be. Timothy, we've already gone through another hour. This is a remarkably fast night. But I'm going to open up the phone lines. I want to continue talking to you about these episodes. But let's let people give you a call as well. They've got many questions for you. This is
great.
You've done just an absolutely stunning job on some of these cases. Many of them I was not even aware of, and I've been looking at this since 1969 as a 19-year-old news kid. It's absolutely riveting. We'll be back in a moment. Timothy is good, and Timothy Good will be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back, Timothy Good, our guest. Your phone calls, boy, they're lining up for you, Timothy. I have to ask you this. I mean, here you are a musician. You're an accomplished violinist. How did you get involved in studying and investigating UFOs?
Well, it goes back to 1955, George, when a cousin in America, actually the guy, I think, to produce the first magazine on computers, it was called Computers and Automation, back in the late 40s, I think, a guy called Edmund C. Berkeley, he was related, and he knew of my passion for all things relating to aviation and space travel. I knew an awful lot about airplanes when I was that age. In fact, by the time I was 10 years old, I used to subscribe to professional type journals and things on aviation. So I'd be mad nuts about aircraft, spacecraft. And he said, "Well, Timothy, you know, what do you know about flying saucers?" And I said, "No." And so he sent me this book by Kehoe, The Flying Saucers Are Real. And I've never looked back. That was it, because all these pilots and air traffic controllers were reporting these things, and that was good enough for me.
Okay, let's go to some of the phones. East of the Rockies, you're on Coast to Coast with us. Hi there.
Hi, this is John calling from Lima, Ohio.
Hey, John. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, thanks. I saw something one time, and I didn't really realize what I had seen until after the fact. My wife and I were going out to a restaurant, and over by a Procter & Gamble plant, which a lot of your soaps that you use are made right here in Lima. I saw a triangle, and I thought it was a Christmas decoration until we went back around the same route during the daylight, and I looked for where I thought it would be mounted at and couldn't find a mounting. So it was definitely kind of eerie to see what wasn't there.
Can you describe this triangle any more than that, John?
To me, it looked like a Christmas decoration, you know.
Yeah. Can you elaborate on that?
A lot of colored lights.
Okay.
Multiple colored lights from top to bottom. We were moving along the road, so it was kind of hard to tell if it was moving or not. But it looked to be approximately, maybe about 80 feet off the ground.
Okay.
But personally, I think all of this has to do with genetic manipulation. The UFO phenomenon, the fallen angels, the ghosts, that they are trying to genetically manipulate us. And the only reason I can come to is because they want to alter us for their purpose.
Yeah. I think that I have a feeling that some of them, at any rate, John, that may well be their agenda.
Yeah. Well, thank you.
All right, thank you. What do you think of Jacques Vallée, who is really not that vocal anymore, but he believes that these were interdimensional?
I have the greatest admiration for Jacques Vallée's work and for him as a person. The only point of disagreement is that he's got no time for extraterrestrials, which I find faintly unscientific, to put it mildly. There's an awful lot of evidence that some of these things are perfectly objective, very solid. Yes, interdimensional beings, I have no doubt whatsoever. But it's also possible, as Sir Peter Horsley was told, you remember the Air Marshal who was Deputy Chief of Strike Command, when he had this meeting in London, he was told that aliens are able, they're perfectly solid, but they are able to manipulate dimensions, for example, for space travel. So that, I think, should tell us a lot more. They're not just multidimensional. They're not. Some of them are perfectly physical, just as physical as us, but more able to manipulate other dimensions.
West of the Rockies, you're on Coast to Coast with Timothy Good. Hi there.
Hi, George. How you doing?
Good, sir.
Mr. Bill from Tucson.
Yeah. Hi, Bill.
And I'm talking to my good friend Timothy Good, who flew out to Tucson, and I met him at his hotel. Remember, Timothy? We went out. We had dinner.
I remember very well.
Yes. How you doing, Tim?
I'm fine. Bill, I spent a great deal of money investigating your case.
And
a great
deal
of time.
And that's what I'm calling about tonight.
A great deal of time and trouble, and I'm very sorry, but I do not find your story convincing.
Well, that's what I wanted to ask you about tonight.
No, I do not. I'm very sorry.
I've heard the stories about earlier tonight. You said if the government wants to make it go away, or the Navy wants to make it go away.
Yep.
And yet, my question for you tonight is, have you ever contacted the two witnesses, which was Paul Hoffman and Kevin Leahy, which were the two men who witnessed the event
with you,
the shock test?
Well, unfortunately, Bill, you didn't give me anybody's address or contact number. You simply mentioned the first name of one of the witnesses. So, you know, if you're coming up with them now, I'm afraid it's too late, because I pleaded with you to try and give some support to your story. I've been in touch with the commanding officer for a long time, Rear Admiral Joseph Barth, on the case, as you know, as I told you. I met him in Washington. Spent a great deal of time. I filed a Freedom of Information request. I finally got the complete shock test report, which unclassified report from via the executive officer, and you are completely out in your timing of the first shock test. I'm not going to give you the privilege of knowing exactly when it took place, but you're trying to say that the event when you saw these craft come out of the sea took place at a certain time, and there's no way it could have taken place at that time.
Some of them don't pan out, do they, Timothy?
No, not in my opinion. I'd like to have been able. I gave Bill the benefit of the doubt. I made a special trip to see him in Arizona. But my opinion is that he is elaborating. I do not find the story convincing. I'd like to have been convinced otherwise.
Sure, I understand.
And in which case it would have been published.
I understand. Okay, well, that's fair enough. First time caller line, you're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hi, George?
Yeah, hi.
Oh, and this is Bonnie. I'm just a few blocks south of Wright-Patterson Air Force Base.
Ah, well, go over there now, Bonnie, and check those things out for us.
I'd love to. I have some students, actually, from Wright-Pat, piano students, but I'm just afraid to ask them because I'm sure it would embarrass them just asking questions about the past. But anyway.
You never know.
Yeah, I just wanted to tell you congratulations for all the wonderful things you do. And also a short story about my driving with someone who had, this was in Scotland several summers ago, and someone had taken me out to supper whom I had met in travels of Europe that summer, which was just terrific.
Mm-hmm.
And he coincidentally, although I know you're not going to say coincidentally, was teaching at the University of Glasgow. And anyhow, we had just been driving back from an area just very close to England and Scotland. And it was from a restaurant which did not serve any spirits of any kind. It was a teetotaler restaurant. And so we're driving back to Edinburgh, and it was just pitch black, George, absolutely. The way it gets there were no nighttime lights on the country roads and everything, and we're just driving along in the little car, which was close to the ground, and all of a sudden there was Close Encounters type of experience from the movie, if you can remember all the lights, police lights and everything that were chasing around when the initial UFOs appeared.
Right, I remember that.
And there was that huge race through Ohio, Indiana.
Yeah,
all
and everybody
things.
Pulled over on the side of the road while these things are zooming by.
Yes, yeah. Well, we were talking and just rehashing old times and reunion and all of that, babbling away. And then all of a sudden, these lights came toward us, which were police car lights, evidently. And it just felt like that experience out of close encounters. Well, the one of the police cars caught up with us and just asked for our IDs, which was very strange. And so all was in order, I suppose, and we were told to go ahead toward Edinburgh. And then in the next little way, again, pitch black, and it was by this time quite scary, but the headlights of the car picked up on the right side of the road, creature is all I can call it, about 4 feet high, black and white, and it looked similar to a penguin, had, although large black eyes. But it did resemble a penguin, and I think someone called in to you last week.
Yes, about this, almost the same kind of thing. Yeah.
Looked like, and I didn't get to hear that whole story, but we were just struck silent. So my friend and I, about a half mile later, he said, "Did you see what I saw?" And I said, "Yes." And he said, "Do you want to go back?" I said, "No." So we went on to the University of Edinburgh, where I was staying with a group of wonderful musicians from a major university in this country, and were playing in the beyond the fringe, as they call it out there, for this wonderful music festival. And I was just totally shaken. And it seemed as if a coincidence, which, George, you will not say it is, but Mr. Timothy Good was in the lobby of this building that I was brought back to meet my group that night. And he was there because the London Symphony Orchestra was playing for the festival,
mm-hmm.
Wonderful Edinburgh Festival.
Am I speaking to Bonnie Bromberg?
Oh, yes. Tim, I don't believe you remembered that.
Oh, sure.
Yes, absolutely.
Was this an interesting case, Timothy?
Well, Bonnie's a very good friend from way back, and she knew her father as well.
Yes, we remember that. I remember that with a very fond memory.
How are you doing, Bonnie?
All right, thank you. I've got lots to write about, and I guess I'll just have that.
Please keep in touch. You know, I'm still at the same place, still at the same address. If you've got it, if not, give the producers an email or something, and I'll pass my details on to you.
How many cases do you get that just come to you like this over the years?
Oh, I don't know. So many, many, many.
Thanks for calling, Bonnie. Appreciate you being on Coast to Coast. What do you think of the former Canadian Defense Minister, Paul Hellyer? I've heard mixed things, and let me tell you what I've heard, Timothy. One was he really never witnessed anything. And then after the fact, as a former defense minister, he reacted to the book The Day After Roswell by Philip Corso and Bill Burns, who's co-written a book with me. So I know Bill well, but Hellyer apparently reacted to that when he started talking about things that he thinks he knew, but he wasn't sure. But what's your take?
Well, no, the take on it is he read The Day After Roswell by Corso, and he didn't know whether it was fact or fiction. So he made inquiries with a retired U.S. Air Force general who he'd known while Hellyer was Canadian Minister of Defense back in the Trudeau administration, 1963-67, and asked, you know, was there any truth to it? And he was told it's all true and there's a lot more. And so they subsequently communicated further and learnt a lot about the more. And he was given a lot of information confirming all sorts of things that there was, for example, an extraterrestrial threat, that the United States was preparing for a conflict in space via Space Command, et cetera, et cetera, and that this was all real and a dreadfully serious problem.
Well, he kind of echoes then what Nick Pope has been saying.
Yes. I mean, I can go further because I know there's a threat, you know, and of course you won't get anyone in government.
Are you concerned about the threat?
George, I'm a great deal more concerned about the threat from human beings on this planet.
I would think so, yeah.
quite frankly. But I mean, I'll give a quick quote. You know that last year, September 2005, at the University of Toronto during the Canadian Disclosure Project conference, this former Minister of Defense, Paul Hellyer, stated, "UFOs are as real as the airplanes that fly over your head. The classification was, from the outset, above top secret, so the vast majority of U.S. officials and politicians, let alone a mere allied Ministry of Defense, were never in the loop."
I'd say what's interesting, Timothy, is here you have with Nick Pope, former defense, part of the Ministry of Defense in the U.K. You have Paul Hellyer, a part of the Ministry of Defense in Canada. You know, all we need is a couple of folks in the United States to come forward, and then we really may be on to something here.
And may I suggest, George, get Nick on the show again. I mean, he'd love to.
Yeah, he was chatting about that last night. He called in briefly this weekend, but I'd love to do another full program.
Oh, great. Good.
And, you know, we'll do that. Because, you know, he's sticking his neck out, and, you know, you got to give the guy credit for that.
Yes. I was with him shortly before his first book came out, and he was very nervous, I can tell you, because while he has his supporters in the Ministry of Defense, there are also, you know, other elements that are not too keen for stuff to come out.
Well, and he's no slouch.
But of course, it was all cleared. Everything was all cleared officially before it was published.
Right.
You have to do that. Anything to do with it.
I mean, he was part of the Afghanistan section, I guess, at the Ministry Department. Just recently.
Well, I wouldn't care to comment, even if I knew, you know, what precisely he was doing. Except, I mean, of course, it is known he was working for defense security, which
True.
Would have included anything to do with any conflict with terrestrials.
So here we are now, 2006, soon to go into 2007.
Yeah.
Are we ever going to get full disclosure?
Short answer, George, I don't know, but I think events on this planet might take a turn for the worse. I think those events, geological and otherwise, are related to the increase in action by extraterrestrials and intraterrestrials, if you like, those that have extraterrestrial liaisons, but they're actually based on this planet. And hopefully the planet will survive in one shape or form. I'm absolutely sure of that. And a lot of what's going on is not necessarily to do with our interference, global warming and everything. I mean, every several thousand years ago, periodically, there are geological and climatic changes on this planet, that's for sure.
All right. Well, you stay with us, Tim. We will be back with Timothy Good. We'll take final phone calls for him. If you need any information on what he's doing, it's timothygood.co.uk. There's a link up, of course, at coasttocoastam.com. If you need to email me, well, you know how to do that, don't you? It's george@coasttocoastam.com. We'll be right back. We'll take your final phone calls right here on Coast to Coast AM. Timothy, what's your take on the transfer of this so-called alien technology to governments like ours? Is it happening? Has it happened?
Oh, sure. It's been happening for a long time.
What kind of technology have they passed on, and why?
Well, I mean, if you go back to the 1947 era when we had a number of craft already, certainly very sophisticated forms of communications, like computer technology, I think, arose out of that to a certain extent, even though our people were working on that in any case, as we know. But, I mean, as Corso explained to a scientist friend of mine, there was a misperception, and I think he wished he'd have corrected it in the book. He said, we actually passed on these materials in early 1961 when he was at the Foreign Technology Desk in the Pentagon. We passed on these things to these various corporate giants at a time when they had begun to start investigating these things and said, here, try, have a look at this. It comes from behind the Iron Curtain. It may give you an edge on the technological stuff that you're working on. But nowadays, goodness knows what's happening, but I think there definitely is liaison with scientific and technical and military specialists, very, very select groups, I would say, with aliens. And goodness knows exactly what they're developing. Certainly, I think spacecraft technology would come into that. And then, of course, that leads to other questions. Why would they allow us to have their technology with our track record? But who knows? Who knows what's going on, George? I wish I did, but there is liaison, I know for a fact.
Well, and again, if you look back at Corso saying that he passed on to industry,
yep,
this kind of technology, and didn't tell him why, just told him to figure it out.
Yes, exactly.
Let's go back to the phones. We'll go to our wild card line. Welcome to Coast. You're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hi. I had a question for Timothy
sure.
about the theory that's out there, that phenomenon that happened in the Bible, whether it be the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah or the wheel Ezekiel saw in the sky, that could be attributed to UFOs interacting with us that early in our timeline.
Oh, absolutely. I have no doubts whatsoever that there's massive evidence for extraterrestrial intervention in human affairs at that time, also in other religious episodes and books.
Okay.
All right.
I could go on forever, you know, but definitely. I mean, I think we've been visited before. I think Christ was almost certainly a hybrid. The angel Gabriel was probably the actual extraterrestrial. There was some kind of artificial insemination or hybridization that took place. If you look at Jesus' extraordinary abilities, the fact that he himself said he was not of this world, the fact he was telepathic, he could levitate, he allegedly ascended bodily into heaven, surrounded with these two guys in shining garments, and went vertically. I mean, you know, what more does one need? Also, the conversion of Paul on the road to Damascus or wherever it was, when this Jesus appeared in a blinding light in the sky. There's a lot of evidence, I think. I mean, I wasn't there. I really don't know. But a lot of these things, I think, can be interpreted in alternatively.
What do you think of the gods of the Greeks?
Sure. I have not studied that period at all, George, but I think all cultures have a history of liaison with advanced beings going way back. And as I say, some of these beings have been on this planet for longer than we have, not just coming from other planets.
Do you think, Timothy, that they're walking among us?
Definitely. I know for a fact. I've encountered three in my life.
Give me one case.
Oh, no.
Why not?
It would take too long, but I think the most significant one was in 1963 on the borders of Arizona and California, when I encountered a young lady who I felt sure was from elsewhere, and she responded to my telepathic query in a very positive and extraordinary way. Likewise, in 1967, in what was then called the Park Sheraton Hotel, Bonnie, who's listening, will remember that we've met there on previous occasions, and I met this man who responded to a telepathic request for proof of alien presence on this planet. And within about an hour of sending out a telepathic signal, that man was sitting beside me, and I asked him to perform a certain sign with his hand, and he did exactly that. So it was obvious he was able to read my mind. There was no communication whatsoever, but I shan't forget him. I'd recognize him if I saw him again. But I had the proof I needed. And my most recent experience, I'm not prepared to go into details at this time, my most recent experience was this year. Now, in the previous encounters, there was no verbal communication. And people say to me, why didn't you talk to this guy? I don't know why I didn't talk to him, George. I sat there like a lemon in New York. I did not talk. I thought if there's any talking to be done. But anyway, this guy could read my mind anyway, and if he wanted to talk, he could have done so. So when the next opportunity arose, this is donkeys, decades later, nothing I've had since that time. And this was, as I say, this year. I didn't have any telepathic proof, but just based on previous experiences and knowledge of how these people operate, I'm convinced this guy could have been from somewhere else. And I actually spoke to him. I didn't say, hey, are you an extraterrestrial? It wasn't like that at all, but I said something to him and shook his hand, and he just looked at me as if I was something the dog had brought in. But I can tell you, it was in a very interesting environment, and there were lots of other people around. It was an extraordinary story, the whole details, but I'm not prepared to go public with that
for quite a long time. We shall respect that. East of the Rockies, you're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hey, how you doing?
Good. Where are you calling from?
I'm calling from Dayton, Ohio.
Okay.
My question is, considering how many people have camcorders nowadays, if there really were flying saucers and stuff, don't you think someone would have gotten a really good video of it and it would have been all over CNN by now? I mean, wouldn't the whole world be in on this?
More picture phones. What do you think, Timothy?
Well, there are thousands of picture phone pictures of UFOs. Most of them are nonsense. But people have taken pictures with videos. There are hundreds of them. Dozens of them are first class, in my opinion. And there's lots of good films, lots of good photographs of UFOs. I've reproduced genuine ones in my latest book. They are there. If you look on the internet, every few days people are taking photographs of these things. I'm afraid to say I'm not convinced. But if you look, some of them are okay.
West of the Rockies, you're up with us on Coast to Coast. Your turn. Hi there.
Hi, this is John from Bonnie Lake, Washington.
Yeah, John.
And my question is this, that if we as individuals could step aside and if we could listen to good versus evil, let's say they wanted to use weights and balances to give us the idea, a concept of what is to be and what they are about. And let's say we could step aside and we could listen if it was our heart's desire to the good. And the good would say, look, this is what it is. This is how it really is. But my question is would we choose to do that or would we want to go ahead and go through the charade and the masks and the confusion and the different intertwining ways that we could perceive things? Or would we want to just get down to the root of the matter?
Hypothetical question, John. I don't know. I can't answer that.
The reason that I would ask that question is because I have done that myself as an individual, but I didn't wittingly know that I was going to do it. It just happened. And being shown what I've been shown, that if that weight were to be presented before an audience, the measurement would tilt way to the side of evil as far as what the is in store or intended for mankind through the greatest deception the world has ever seen or will ever see, but that the good will overcome, will blow it away. But we have to first be able to see the reality for what it is so we can choose what we're going to do with it.
How evil, Timothy, do you believe they may be?
I don't know, but some of them are, in my opinion.
Interesting.
To what extent? I don't know, but
you would think
we've talked about that before.
That this evolution in this universe would get to a point where they, at this point in their life, in their existence, would have gone beyond that. I guess not.
I guess not too, George. I think evil and good exist throughout the cosmos. I've heard it said that this Earth is the battleground for a conflict between good and evil, and I don't discount that theory at all.
No, nor do I. Wildcard Line, you're up with us. Hello there.
Yeah, hello. My name is Richard from Redding, California, and
sure.
Hi to both of you.
Richard, go ahead, sir.
Yeah, hi. I have a couple questions, hopefully, and then a couple statements to let you know where I'm at. This has been going on for 6 years, and I don't know, has the, instead of being abducted away from into a UFO, can it now be done in your own home? I live in an apartment, and I have some things going on for 6 years now, and I do have fair proof of it. Even the doctor does know about it. A regular MD, I have to fight it with pain pills, but and I do get radiated every night. I think it's so they can see me through the walls and be able to work on me. I believe sperm is being also removed from me, and when I do speak about it, I will be penalized, or a better term for it is tortured.
So you think a torture is on its way just because of this call, for example?
Oh, yeah. Oh, I guarantee you.
Right.
I somehow we'll be in the middle of the night. I'll wake up burning completely, and I won't be able to cool down. It's like being microwaved. But is this being mixed up with something like mind control? Because each time I come home, I think I'm walking into a laboratory.
Well, let me tell you, Bud Hopkins has cases, and he's he's the alien abduction expert on the East Coast. Mm-hmm. And, of course, around the whole country. But he has cases of people being systematically removed from their apartments, mm-hmm. from their homes. He has a case, gosh, he wrote a book, Timothy, years ago, and he's convinced that the Secretary General of the United Nations witnessed an abduction with a UFO hovering over this woman's apartment complex in New York City.
Right, yeah.
So what's happening to you, Richard, is probably not that unusual.
Yeah, they're definitely doing mind reading, and they do a click either to the right of me or to the – I have these recorded, too, or either straight ahead from me or to the left of me. And if I have any thoughts of, like, telling someone, my daughter, or speaking to a friend about it, though, it'll be a real loud click onto the right side. If I'm thinking of something natural, there'll just be a click on this side, and it's like they're learning. Someone is either learning or already does know how to mind read 100%. My counselor was listening to me. That was a DUI counselor, because I don't drink no more. I haven't for 6 years or so. But he was listening to me, and he started believing me. But they evidently, someone went to his home and put these clicks in his home and scared the heck out of him. Each time he's getting ready to go to bed, and he called in a termite specialist and a electrician, and they verified that the house was fine, and he came to me and called me out of one of the meetings and said, hey, Richard, I'm scared. What do we do? I said, I don't know. Let's just stop talking about it, and we ceased talking about it, and they didn't bother him no more. And I had one friend walk into my house. He ate dinner here, and when he was walking with the plate towards the kitchen sink, the clicks came from the wall and just like bounced on the floor, tick, 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 click, 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 right towards him. His eyes opened up like crystal balls, and he looked at me, and I said, see what I'm talking about? But they seem alive. They seem I've never seen a so high of technology that's happening. But when I speak out about it, they do not like it. I'll hang notes in the bulletin board where I'm at an apartment complex, and I will get penalized for that. Anything I find on the web or anything that kind of matches me, I will try and I want to let someone know that something's going on, and it's very intelligent, extremely intelligent.
So it's interesting that they're taking things they're just taking them out on you. That's strange. Strange indeed. Richard, thanks for the call. Appreciate it. Just a few minutes left. We'll take a few more calls, Timothy, and then we shall call it a night.
Yeah, just say,
let you react to that.
I'm underwhelmed by that case.
Underwhelmed?
Very much so.
Okay, tell me why.
Well, borderline, I would say.
So something's happening to him, but you don't think it's alien?
I don't think so.
Maybe he's Creed.
Something's happening to him.
Right.
So he thinks, yes.
Exactly.
But may I say that I'll be speaking my next visit to the States in April at the Ozark International UFO Conference. Linda Howe's talking too. This
sure.
is 13th to the 15th of April. And the contact number is, if I can give the email, it's ozarkufo@webtv.net. I repeat that, ozarkufo@webtv.net.
Do you have a link on your website on this yet?
I don't think so. I'm not sure.
Okay.
But also, my book will be available, I hope, at that event.
It's available in Canada now, though, and we broadcast to Canada now.
Is it?
Oh, yeah, that's what I'm told. I'm told that Amazon of Canada has it.
Oh, in that case, U.S. citizens will be able to get it that way, because it's been difficult getting it. It's actually available on Amazon at half price.
Well, that's a great deal.
Over here, but if you can get it, if U.S. citizens can get it on Canada, I'm delighted. Let me have more information. It's news to me.
Yeah, according to my webmaster, it's available Amazon Canada, and you can pick it up that way.
Oh, great. Okay.
Well, see, they're pretty aggressive people. As we wrap this up, Timothy, Why don't you give us about a minute synopsis of where you think this is all headed?
Oh, George, I couldn't possibly do it because I don't know. You're asking me to speculate. And
I don't care to speculate. Way.
But I think that events are accelerating on this planet and that there are going to be some pretty dramatic changes. Now, if I can quote from an alleged contact with an extraterrestrial, which I wrote about extensively in my last book, Unearthly Disclosure.
Very quickly,
it was reported by Enrique Castillo Rincon, and he was given a lot of information about what was happening in the future. There were going to be future desperate changes, that some people were being influenced, and that, it's claimed that there will be a third world war. But it's just a prophecy. However, when prophecies start to come true, I pay attention. And this is what was said. The Great War will be preceded by a shorter one. At first, no nuclear weapons will be used. Pay much attention to environmental changes, the ozone layer, the weakness of your leader, and their lack of credibility, of your leaders, I should say, and their lack of credibility, loss of religious values, which the religious claim to have, the growth of crime, and the lack of countermeasures against it. No government on earth will be able to win the battle against crime and insecurity.
Sounds like, Tim, that it's happening right now. Thank you so much for being on Coast to Coast. For Steve Carr, Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean LaDesur, Ian Punnett, Art Bell, Ross Mitchell, Alan Corbett helping out, and Stephanie Smith. I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. I'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.